Welcome to the edges of darkness. Light a candle, say our name. Sit back and listen to Haunted NTL's Bloody Marys.
I'm Pars, hi.
I'm Nicole.
I'm Kristen.
And I'm Voodoo Priestess, and we are the Bloody Marys.
So first would be the disclaimer. This episode is going to have certain material that people might not be comfortable listening to. Some of it will be sexual in nature. Some of it's not exactly voluntary. So warning about that. And all of our thoughts are our own and do not represent the thoughts of our mother website, Haunted MTL.
We are talking about The Bloody Chamber, Angela Carter's The Bloody Chamber. I got a collection of stories, but I only read The Bloody Chamber.
Yeah, well, I think The Bloody Chamber, just the story itself, 45 pages long, has plenty of stuff to talk about.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I can do that. The Bloody Chamber is a not modern, but modern for the time retelling of Bluebeard. For those who don't know, Bluebeard is about an impressionable young woman who is married to a very well-off count who she finds out later is murdering his ex-wives in horribly gruesome ways. She is saved at the end of it by miscellaneous people, depending on the Bloody Chamber. Spoilers, but the story is older than all of us. She is saved by her mother.
It's a retelling of Bluebeard, and that I just read that today. But they're different too.
Very much so. Definitely more pro-feminism on the Carter version.
Yeah, absolutely.
And can I just say that I found really funny in the original, the reason nobody really likes Bluebeard is because his beard is blue. And the reason the mother takes issue with Bluebeard is because he's been married several times and all his wives have died.
Yeah, you'd think that would have been the problem in the original one, too. But everyone's like, no, that's fine.
Also, too, that in the original, he was so wealthy that you might think most people could look past the Bluebeard, but it took a while.
It took everyone getting drunk.
Yeah, before they agreed. In the original telling that we read by Perrault, I believe, Charles Perrault.
Saying, I don't know, like, if it was that big of a deal, why he didn't just shave his beard?
Yeah, or like hair dye has been around for like as long as people have been people.
So the new story is pro-feminism and the old story just is not logical. That's we learned.
It's not, it's pretty anti-feminism. I mean, she's saved by her seven strong brothers. For those who haven't read the original one, she asks Bluebeard if she can say her prayers, and she's actually shouting out the window to her brothers to come save her. And that is what ends up happening. Her seven brothers come and save her, and then she gives them all a bunch of money, and everyone lives happily ever after with Bluebeard's money.
For the kids.
Yeah, these fairy tales.
One thing I find weird about the original, but there's actually a lot to like in the way that Angela Carter updated it. But in the original, at least in the site that we read the original on, or at least the one that was posted earlier today, is that the moral of the story is basically curiosity killed the cat. And it's like, I don't know. Wouldn't you want to know if your husband's murdering his wives?
Yeah, that, in fairness to Bluebeard, I know I'm about to say that. In both cases, he's like, I have this big, beautiful mansion. It's all yours. Do whatever you want with any of it. Invite anybody over. Do anything. Just don't go in this one room. And it's like, you couldn't even do that. Like, that is one very small thing to be asked.
I wondered, and I mean, I have no information for this, but going on what you were saying, I wondered if there was possibly an element of Bluebeard himself in the Angela Carter version, like possibly being cursed or something, because it talked about the opal ring had been passed down and passed down and passed down that he gives her, and you know, all the wives had died. And he seemed, I kind of got the impression on the way along that he may have had like a little bit of reluctance to what he did. So, I mean, not that he had an excuse, but I was wondering if there was any little hint of that in there, that maybe there was like a generational curse or something. I don't know. I wonder like what he would have done with her if she hadn't opened it.
I've always kind of wondered that. I think in the original one that if he felt more reluctant, in this one, it felt like he tricked her. It felt like he set it up as a trap and he knew she was going to do it. He was just looking for an excuse.
I definitely think he set it up, yes, and that he planned to. I just didn't know if maybe he was compelled by like some sort of evil force or something. Maybe I was just giving him a little bit of the benefit of the doubt, but I'm sure it's not accurate.
So in Angela Carter's version, I did make note in a few different places where there's like, just because you said that, there's like vampire imagery on there, and yeah. I thought that was kind of odd to add into Bluebeard.
Yeah, I definitely think there is an element like with the ruby necklace where it talks about that they had made the necklace to represent like the red threads that the French aristocracy had worn to symbolize like having escaped the guillotine, and you know, the idea of blood. And I agree too. It had a little bit of that flair as well.
That was one of the things I actually had marked, but like straight up the Carmilla and the Transylvanian Countess, because Carmilla is the original story, is the first, I think, vampire story ever really told. I feel like having the Iron Maiden in there, I feel like that was also a kind of, either because of all the blood or because of like the way of Vlad the Impaler or Elizabeth Bathory, the torture ways, it just seemed very vampiric. It seemed kind of odd to like put that in a Bluebeard story.
So I went to page 35, which is where he found out, and on page 34, it says when she comes back with a bunch of keys, she says, it seemed to me he was in despair. And then on page 35, she kind of looks at him some more and references the atrocious loneliness of that monster, which is kind of a theme that you would see sometimes with like, with a vampire, or maybe even like Beauty and the Beast, which she retells later. But there's a part where he says, oh, my love, my little love, who brought me a white gift of music, he said, almost as if grieving. My little love, you'll never know how much I hate daylight. So that's kind of where I get the idea that maybe he was reluctant somehow, but felt like he had to do it for whatever reason.
Have you guys seen Maniac?
No.
No.
So he's almost grieving, but not quite.
That's like, true.
Not enough to say he's grieving. What if it's some sort of need or feeling of wanting to hurt women for, you know, whatever reason? It could be like a family thing, generational thing, a mother thing, whatever it is. You know, there's this struggle of that not being morally or socially acceptable with the deep need or desire to hurt women.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to clarify, I'm not trying to say that like he's not an evil person or anything. I just didn't know if maybe there was more, like you said, like a generational element to it or something you know, he was kind of felt compelled somehow. But yeah, I mean, yeah, obviously he is compelled to do evil if he is compelled, or maybe it's a full choice. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know, I think it felt more like, you know, the significant other who puts you through a wall then says, well, look what you made me do. Why do you have to make me so angry? Mm. That's how that character felt.
Yeah, I can see that.
I see that.
I could definitely see that.
Yeah, and then it's just a repeating pattern that you see, you know, in those relationships and then with his wives. That's a good interpretation.
I also thought it was significant. His past wives had all been very successful women with their own careers or their family name, or that, you know, they were women of standing, women who thought well of themselves and should have, and stood up on their own two feet. And it's like he feels, well, he has this different type of girl now who has nothing and nobody. And I absolutely feel he treats her like a child largely, I think, in the way he handles sex and sexual relations with her.
I think he specifically was interested in her virginity. Mm-hmm. Like you're saying, he said it was the first time he would have, one of his wives was a virgin.
I thought it was just like such a creepy and douchey thing to say, because on page 16 here, he's, you are a virgin, but because these are more civilized times, I'm not going to put the bedspreads out to show everyone that you are totally a virgin when I banged you. That's just like,
yeah.
What do you get from that?
It was something that was historically done when a noble or royal person would be married, then they would hang out sheets, presumably a bloody sheet, to show that the girl was a virgin. And there were actually ways that some women were known to circumvent that if perhaps they were not virgins, or if they did not bleed, because that's a myth that you always bleed. But so yeah, that was a custom that was probably actually taking place, which is very gross.
Yeah, it is incredibly messed up.
I knew that it was a real thing that happened. I just think because this is actually a modern retelling, and the way this book is written, it can sometimes kind of take you out. You forget that it's set in the modern era.
Yeah.
There's cars and telephones and all that in here, except you can easily forget about that. And so when they say something like that, that's specifically hearkening to olden times, while at the same time being all like, but it's not those times. It's just very odd. So straight up in this book, in the Angela Carter's version, Bluebeard's kind of an asshole. Mm-hmm. Like, there's just no way to get around it. And Tyr's infantizing her because using sex. It's like, when she looks through his books and she comes across the porn and he starts baby talking her while calling her baby.
Yeah.
Like, have the nasty picture scared baby. Baby mustn't play with grown-up toys till she's learned how to handle them, must she?
Yeah, and it's complete domination. Like, yeah. Trying to dominate, yeah.
It's not exactly rapey, but it's kind of rapey when they actually sleep together, because you can tell she doesn't really want to, but she's going to do it because that's her duty as a wife, and it's very, very uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think was the purpose of Angela Carter putting that in the book, I guess?
To display a potential prison within an institution we're told is good.
I thought it was more of the bargain we always say that, you know, if someone who marries into a wealthy relationship, you know, we always say, well, they're making a deal. And it's, I don't want to say basically a high-paid prostitute, but that you're giving up your freedom to make certain choices because now you'll have a comfortable life. Not that I agree with that, but I think that's the point of view she was taking for this character.
Yeah, I think it was definitely kind of part of the bargain, like you said. And throughout the story, I think there are certain hints and certain times where she starts to feel like she might be interested in sex, or she might be, you know, she said at one point, it said something like, she desired him, but she was also repulsed by him. But I think the way that it actually went down, you know, she was not prepared for it. But I thought it was kind of an interesting portrayal of maybe being curious about something, but not ready for it. And then obviously he did not handle it with delicacy. But, you know, I don't know. I think she had a lot of questions throughout the whole thing.
Well, did she really choose to get married to him? I forgot how that worked in the different...
Yeah, on the very first page, her mother says, because the mom's kind of trying to talk her out of it, and she says, are you sure you love him? And she says, I'm sure I want to marry him. That's the first thing she actually says in the story, and says something about her mother maybe being in debt or something. So maybe that's why she made that choice.
And I loved that, because there's just a very distinction. There's a very strong distinction between those two things. Stupid little note, but did anyone else really think that, like, shrimp and avocado sounded like an amazing meal?
Yes.
Together?
Every kind of ice cream.
I know. Like, that was the most relatable moment. When she's like, you know what? I want shrimp and avocado for dinner.
I agree. That's like my daughter's. Actually, it's like my daughter's two favorite foods. That's funny.
Oh, those are like my two favorite foods.
Awesome.
You guys were talking about the distinction between wanting to get married and just wanting to be, and whether or not she was in love. Did anyone else notice like the word choices in here? Because I was saying that it was like a really sexually charged story, but there actually is really unsexy. The sheer descriptions that the narrator uses.
Very much so, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Though I wrote, word choice, really good word choice. And then her build of dread was really good over on page 26. And I wonder if Chuck Palahniuk has read her, because they have a lot, they have similar storytelling techniques. So on page 32, for example, that crash of a dropstick, his shiver-headed cane, what else? Sly cunning, he had returned. He was waiting for me outside the door. So she thought it was, her husband coming home. I rose to my feet. Fear gave me strength. I flung back my head defiantly. Come in. My voice astonished me by its firmness, its clarity. The door slowly, nervously opened, and I saw not a massive, irredeemable bulk of my husband, but the slight, stooping figure of the piano tuner. That's something Chuck would do. Like, that's for the audience. But I read a lot of Chuck.
Sadly, I don't think I've read any of his books.
I've read a few, but that's like a very long time ago. I remember he has like totally crazy and awesome story ideas. It's beautiful.
It very much felt like anything to do with sexuality, and this wasn't, sexy, happy, fun times or warmth or companionship or anything like that. It was all very gruesome, very more like an attack. All the word choices were very violent and vulgar.
Well, there is actually a line, I think I have a different edition than you guys do, but on page 26, the quote is, "There is a striking resemblance between the act of love and the ministrations of a torturer," opined my husband's favorite poet. So exactly like you're saying, and it comes right out and says that at one point. And I don't know who the poet is supposed to be. I'm going to actually try to find that. But yeah, that being her husband's favorite poet shows how he feels about that.
I say, yeah, this wouldn't be somebody like Bukowski, maybe? I don't know.
It's from Baudelaire, who was a French poet known for writing on kind of decadent themes. So according to Google, that is the source of that quote. His most famous work was a book of lyric poetry titled Le Fleur du Mal, The Flowers of Evil. That was really influential. So I think that's what she's referring to.
That puts a dark and unsavory level onto Series of Unfortunate Events.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Oh, there is so many dark references in that. I love it so much.
Oh, yeah. Like, little kids read it and great, you learn some new words. Adults read it like, nope, that's deep. That's terrifying. We read this as children?
Looking back over this, and she writes with ferocity.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great way to describe it.
Very much so. The way she describes the main character's mother coming in to rescue her at the end is just amazing. You really can picture this woman just flying in on a horse, her hair flying behind her, just ready to kick some ass. I thought it was great.
Well, and she talks about where she first introduces her mother, that she says that her mother had shot a man-eating tiger and that she always had her gun with her.
Mm-hmm.
So, she's gonna be a badass.
Yeah, I loved that. I love any fairy tale where it's not the princess being rescued by the prince, or in the case of the original one, the seven strong brothers.
I thought it was great that, yes, I totally agree, but I also loved that it was her mother, because I feel in a lot of fairy tales, the mother is always absent. She's either dead and there's a wicked stepmother, or they get lost or something and the mother's not around. And I think actually representing the mother as the savior in the fairy tale really kind of turned that on its head. That was so striking to me the first time I read it, because that's just not generally what happens. I mean, I don't know if I can really think of another classic fairy tale where the mother saves the day. Somebody will probably think of one now, but...
Not any but that I can think of.
Angela Carter, I read some about her in the introduction to this book, and she actually had kind of a troubled relationship with her mother, and her mother had died not too long before she wrote The Bloody Chamber. So I wondered if maybe that was a little bit of something she would have wanted her mother to be like, although obviously that's pure speculation.
I actually read a bit on Angela Carter too, and from what I heard of her troubled relationship with her mother is that both her mother and father were like super doting parents, and they were like super overprotective of her. And once she hit puberty or whatever, she realized that they were kind of crazy, or not crazy, but like super over the top. And that's when she went all bad girl.
Yeah, you're right. And then I did read that like right before her mother died, her mother was so angry at Angela Carter for getting a divorce. She actually initiated a divorce from her husband that she wouldn't speak to her. And she actually turned away from her and died without speaking to her at the end, which I assume because she didn't approve of the divorce, which was just really sad.
That's messed up.
You know, a lot when I was reading, because I read up on Angela Carter and everything first, and reading The Bloody Chamber, it's just like, it's kind of sad because you kind of get beat certain beats that what happened in Angela's life with what's happening in the story.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of sad when you read through it like that. I mean, because, okay, she married young, and I think there was a quote, I'll like link this into the summary when this is uploaded, the article that was read, but there was a quote that basically she married her first husband because before they slept together he wanted to be married, and he was the first guy who showed an interest in sleeping with her. I think that's something that she actually said. She left him when she was overseas. She cheated on him, actually, and then divorced him through a letter. And she met the next person who she spent the rest of her life with a couple years, 5 years later or something. And they never actually got married. Like, the piano tuner dude, they never got married. They just hung out until she was diagnosed with cancer. And then she married him so he could take custody of the children or child. And
that's a good point about the piano tuner. I didn't put that together, but you're right. That's a good observation, how they'd never married.
And I also thought, because at the end of the story, I thought it was really weird how she said that because he was blind, he couldn't see the mark on her forehead, because in Angela Carter's story, Bluebeard presses the key against her forehead and it leaves this bloody mark. And she says how that mark is her greatest shame. And I thought that was so weird because, sure, it's a shame in the fact that she didn't listen to her husband, but it's mostly, like, she didn't die. Like, there is nothing about that in the story that would actually be, like, the piano tuner will see that and be all like, oh, I guess you're unfit to be married or whatever.
Do you think maybe she said it was her greatest shame because the thing she was ashamed of was like marrying him in the first place? Like, I wondered if she, not that she should be ashamed of it, but I was wondering if maybe it was like the regret that she had. I don't know. Because yeah, she didn't really do anything that was that shameful. So why she saw that as her own greatest shame? It's a good point. I don't know exactly. But yeah,
or
like
weakness.
Yeah,
she wasn't strong, or that she thought she wasn't strong.
Yeah, I think that's how I saw it, was more of a, like, she was ashamed that she'd married for a less than savory reason, or it could be hearkening to a lot of people who get out of an abusive relationship are so gaslit they consider it their fault, and they really have to take years to shake that off.
Yeah, that's a good point, too.
But with the thing that you said about the mother, the ending seems sadder because it feels like that's what she would have wanted her mother to do during it, to be there to help her through it and to have somebody there. And then she just doesn't have anyone in reality. And it's,
yeah, you know, that's a really good point when you think about it, because the mom comes and saves her out of the bad marriage. Whereas obviously out of murder, whereas in Angela Carter's life, you know, her mom wanted her to stay in the marriage because of, you know, it being scandalous or whatever to get a divorce. So yeah, you're right. Like, that may have been a part too that was influenced by her life.
So do you guys think there was any symbolism in the fact that the piano tuner was blind?
Yeah, because blind people can use it in a number of different ways, whether it's like they can't see the whole situation, you can't see the past, you're ignorant of certain ideas or things that have happened. Basically, at the end of the story, the piano tuner guy is, he stays with her, but then there's like no judgment. There's no questioning of, I don't even know if they actually cleared out the closet of bodies, but that's something else. There's just nothing that he holds against her. Like, he stays with her during the whole execution thing, even though he knows he's gonna die next. And the fact that he can't see it all coming, I feel like probably helped steal his resolve in that regards. He didn't run screaming when he could have.
Well, and I also think it's relevant that the one and only thing that Bluebeard valued in the main character was her beauty. And he likes that she played piano, but his big thing was, you know, she was so beautiful. The piano tuner couldn't see her. He valued her for her music. He valued her for her talent. Presumably because she was a nice person later, because she was a little bit kind of a dick to him.
Well, yeah, like, he said that he, loved the piano. The guy did, said he loved the piano, but he was more interested in her physical body. And then the other, the blind guy actually loved her music. But how is this for relevance, guys? You disobeyed him, he said. That is sufficient reason for him to punish you.
That's messed up.
Do you think he meant that in a, well, that's kind of what husband do kind of way? Or I'm pretty sure this is what his mindset is at.
Yeah, I think that's a possibility, kind of like he said. Right, kind of like you said, like, well, for him, that's enough reason to punish you. Mm-hmm. Kind of like he knew that's what he was like. But I don't know. I could see it going either way. But he does also say, you do not deserve this. So I'm wondering. He says, you do not deserve this. And then she says, who can say what I deserve or no? I've done nothing, but that may be sufficient reason for condemning me. And then the piano tuner says, you disobeyed him. That is sufficient reason for him to punish you. So right. Maybe he's saying, you don't deserve it, but he's going to do it anyway. You know, that there's a lot that's just open to interpretation.
And this, I think, is one of the very few downsides to reading over listening to someone saying lines. There's a huge difference between that's sufficient enough reason for him to punish you and that's enough sufficient enough reason for him to punish you.
I feel like because she is talented with writing and she knows what she's doing with her words, I feel like she could have said that differently. Like, she said it this way for a reason, for it to have the dual kind of resonance, or not dual meaning, but sort of resonant after it's read, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I could see that.
But I wonder if it's that he just has this thing for hurting women.
He definitely seems to enjoy it. Of the different deaths, this character's death was certainly going to be the most merciful.
Yeah, the quickest.
Or dominating over. Yeah, definitely. But I mean, that's
still happening today.
I don't know why I was surprised when she goes to the courtyard and there's a sword there. I knew he was going to behead her, but I was like expecting a straight up guillotine in his backyard that they just overlooked the entire time.
Well, it is France, you know. Maybe they had one lying around.
I was frustrated with that character, like, the entire way through. Like, until the end of it. Like, you know the guy's probably going to kill you. As soon as you realize that, why don't you leave? And she's like, well, I don't know if I could. Like, no, you've got all that money in that house. Throw some stuff in a bag and go. Like, take some type of responsibility for your life here.
Well, could she? I was trying to figure out, because wasn't there something like the telephone wouldn't call out? Because her mom had to call her and it said something about the telephone not calling out. And then weren't they like on, was there like a ferry that was involved in getting her over there? I thought maybe there was a reason she couldn't leave, but I could be wrong.
So far as I remember, and I could also be wrong, I think her biggest concern was that all she could think to do would be to run to the nearest village. And she wondered if the men of that village would be in cahoots with him because he had so much money.
Yep, you're right. That's right. Yeah, so she could have tried to do something.
Well, there was, hold on, was there another, a maid?
Yeah.
Yeah, like a housekeeper or something.
I think when Bluebeard came back and he went to his wife, he was all like, I dismissed all our staff so we could have an alone time. So.
Yes, yeah. That's right.
I did think if she was going to stay there, she could have made like smarter choices, such as actually asking the house people when they were there if they could help her go to visit her mother because she can't because the phones are down or something. Or, you know, when she has the bloodstain key, accidentally cut her hand or something and, you know, bloodstain all the keys.
Mm-hmm. That's a, yeah.
Yeah. Or just kind of not been very dismissive of them. Like, I don't understand the mentality of someone who says, I'm going to be in this big house with all these servants, but I'm going to be alone. Like, no, there are all these people for you to talk to and be friends with and just not be a haughty bitch.
Well, I do think at one point she was kind of intimidated by them, because there was one point where she said something like the housekeeper or something was more of a lady than she was, and, you know, she didn't exactly know how she was supposed to act. But then, yeah, I think she kind of decided to just not care, maybe, because of that. Did anybody notice the theme that she has the painting of Saint Cecilia hanging in the music room that he bought her, and at another time he actually refers to her as Saint Cecilia and basically says, come down Saint Cecilia so I can kill you. And I looked it up, and apparently Cecilia was a saint who had taken a vow of virginity but was forced to marry a pagan nobleman, then later was killed with a sword. I just thought, I mean, obviously she incorporated that into the story, and I just thought that was really interesting. I just thought there was a whole bunch of things that I just kept finding that were allusions to different works of art, literature, like the opera Tristan and Isolde. All of those references, they all were related to the text, which I thought was really interesting, and that she did that really well. Like, there's a painting called Sacrificial Victim. She points that out. There's another painting that the guy has called The Foolish Virgins. I mean, she just had stuff all the way throughout that were like these Easter eggs. I just thought it was so cool.
I think those could also be known as glaring red flags that you've made a huge mistake.
Absolutely.
That kind of goes back to like all the word choices and stuff. Because the thing that struck me was that we're doing this from the narrator's point of view, the newlywed wife point of view, and it's like, she is the one seeing these, and she's the one mentioning them and describing things this way, and mm-hmm. I just find that very, very hilarious, because at one point, she calls her bedroom, because he bought all these lilies for her, like a funeral parlor. She compares it to a funeral parlor, and it's, she describes the castle and the way around it like a place where sirens would be, and, you know, like somewhere gets lured to their death.
And I thought it was like an underworld movie. That's what I pictured.
Yeah, at one point I think she says the stems of the lilies look like disembodied arms or something. They're like, she's looking at the lilies in a vase and saying that looks like limbs. I don't know. It was all so creepy.
It was. And wasn't the room also like floor to ceiling mirrors?
Yes.
And that was super weird. Like, not somewhere that I would like to think of being intimate with anyone in. Probably TMI, but still. Like, it's just the whole thing. It's just very gross and weird.
And she thinks nothing of it. She just goes on life.
Yeah. She's like, no, this is fine.
Well, maybe that's part of, you know, because it keeps referencing like her virginity, her innocence, like she's never had a boyfriend. She's never, I don't think, really been away from home much or anything. So maybe she's just kind of like, oh, I guess that's how it is. I don't know. Very naive. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah. I've got it here. If I rang for them, a maid would bring me chocolate. So I wrote, yeah, really well-written naivety.
And even when she's talking to her mom and she says, she's trying to think of something to say, and she says, I have gold bath taps. I have these gold dolphin bath taps. The mom figures out that something is amiss. But yeah, like that's what she, you know, all these things. She's kind of dazzled by it, I think. But also I want those chocolates too.
Right. I did love that line at the ending. I knew something was wrong because who ever heard of crying because of gold dolphin bath taps? Yeah.
So, because you guys were mentioning how this might be kind of like an allegory for an abusive relationship earlier, I guess the authoress, however you want to put it, is very good at reinforcing that just by the way that even though she does have the servants and she's not technically alone in there, she's pretty much alone. She's separated from everyone that she knows and the life that she's kind of comfortable with, which is kind of weird. And she does get paranoid about where can she go if she actually leaves the house. So.
Right, but the he said somebody was just as much the house as he was.
Yeah, I think she said that about the maid. She thought the maid would be on his side for the housekeeper or whatever. She said she was alone.
Yeah.
And in that loneliness, I just want to bring up, how did no one bring to her attention that there were rumors that his entire family went on hunting sprees in which they hunted down and beheaded young women? How was that a thing? But somehow she never knew about it.
Yeah, you'd think like when she was dating him, like someone would have pulled her aside and been like, do you know anything about this guy? Like, let me tell you this. Like, did she have no friends that were looking out for her best interest or?
Yeah, that's a good point. It never really talks about her knowing anyone else besides her mom. I mean, she goes to the music school, but beyond that, yeah, I don't know. Oh, one thing I was going to point out was when, so the guy buys her the wedding dress and he buys her mother a dress too. Her mother's dress is made of black silk, which seems like something that you would wear to a funeral. So it's like the wedding is almost like her funeral as well.
I thought that mother-in-laws traditionally wore black to weddings.
Really? Well, maybe I just don't know that then.
Maybe I just, maybe my family's just weird. Maybe I picked that up somewhere. But
I don't know.
This is definitely a story that needed to be both told and retold. And I'm really glad that she did write it. You know, talking further with you guys about it, I'm going to put more thought into reading more of her work. Yeah, I really enjoyed reading this.
Yeah, I'm astounded and appalled that this author has never come up in any English class I have ever taken. Maybe not this one, because all of my English classes were in high school. But, like, how has this never, I've never heard of this author before in any class I've ever taken.
Yeah.
So I actually have heard of this author before, not because of the class, but there's a cult classic movie out there called In the Company of Wolves. And you guys, you should totally watch that movie. It is gorgeous. It's basically Little Red Riding Hood retelling, as, you know, Angela Carter does. And it's just such a surreal and gorgeous movie to watch. I really do recommend it. That's why I actually came upon her. I looked her up and I read parts of this stories that were put into that movie. It's just really interesting how the books go, the stories and everything. Honestly, some of them, not all of them, feel modern. Like, The Bloody Chamber was very obviously a modern because of the technology that was in there. And some of them are just retellings of the stories where they bring up different points or have different attitudes that are not the same as when the original fairy tales came out. Like I said, with the original Bluebeard, I heard the moral was basically curiosity killed the cat. And in the newer one, it was not a cut and dry morality tale. Like, most fairy tales are cautionary or moral stories. And I think Angela Carter does good to bring a sort of nuance and emotion to them.
One thing I did want to mention in the original, so the main character in the original one really cared about her husband, really loved him. She liked who he was and saw past the beard and thought he was a very lonely man. Originally, he was like, hey, please don't go in there. And she's like, okay, cool, whatever. The only reason why she does it is because her sisters, who are jealous of the marriage she made, goad her into it.
Now that you mention that, that is also very similar to the Greek myth of Cupid and Psyche. Cupid tells Psyche not to look at him ever because, like, he's a god and, like, she can't look at him. And then her sisters say, like, oh, he's probably really ugly. You need to see what he looks like and trick her kind of into lighting a candle. Yeah, so but now that you said it, like, thinking about that, it's interesting. It's kind of a similar premise.
Yeah, so I think there's a little bit of that moral in the original is, you know, don't give in to peer pressure, and also your sisters who have been mean to you your whole life. Yeah. Maybe they don't have your best interest at heart.
Yeah, I mean, it goes from showing women being harmful to women, and then in the new one, we get women helping women.
Well, there was a little bit of that mentality in the new one, because the reason she goes and looks in that one closet was because she found a correspondence of his old wife. She was jealous. I'm not even sure if it was jealousy, because at the end of the day, it kind of showed her that she really didn't know him all that well. And this was something else to learn about him. But it was sort of because it was his old wife, and she was wondering if he still had feelings for her.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of it in that context before. The massive difference between the competition almost between her and her sisters in the original one. So yeah, I think that was an appropriate and probably intentional update.
Would you say it makes it more feministic just because they like took out more female characters to work on what they had?
I think so, because, well, she had seven sisters, air quotes, they're always referred to them as that. It could have been one sister and been exactly the same thing. They had no personalities, it was just their seven sisters.
They were all the dancing princesses.
Right.
Is there anything else that they wanted to kind of talk about with this?
Everyone should read Angela Carter.
Yes, and there's a movie out that if you read The Body Chamber, it's something that interests you in the horror genre, I would check out. I think you still have to rent it, but it should be free soon enough. It's called Swallow. Look at the synopsis, because it's a slow burn. You'll either want to watch it or you won't.
That sounds cool. I'll check it out.
Mm, yeah.
Oh, I just Googled it. That looked good. I'm going to look into it.
Okay. But next time we're going to be meeting up for The Exorcist. We might do something else between now and then.
The Exorcist is a full-length novel, huh?
Yeah.
Which I am ashamed to say I have never read before, but I'm very excited to.
It's a great book. It's so well written.
Is there any short stories in the meantime we might talk about if we get to it earlier, or do you guys want to focus solely on The Exorcist?
I don't know. Do you have any suggestions? Any
time pars make it all about me.
I did just actually get a copy of The Lottery, you guys.
Ooh.
And I've never read that.
Neither have I.
Seriously?
Like, yeah, I know what it's about, but, like, I've never sat down and read it.
All-time classic.
What I heard of it, it reminded me of Storm of the Century. A scene in Storm of the Century. So, and I don't know, I don't know really anything. So that might be an option, guys.
That's a good idea. Yeah.
Okay. Because I also think it's the short story itself is free online. If it's not, there's like a million anthologies that have it. Probably own it on our bookshelves and don't even know it.
Yeah.
I know it was published in the New Yorker, and I know you can read a certain amount of free articles, I think. I don't know if that counts in their archives, but you could search on there because you might be able to read it on their website.
And with that, the Bloody Marys are signing off. Be sure to join us next time when we discuss Shirley Jackson's The Lottery.